Want to talk to you about God and the Skeptics in our part two, talking about seven reasons for faith. The fifth reason is Christ's sacrifice on the cross. I trust that this will open your thinking to a concept that in the infinite necessity of God, when he chose to do what he chose to do, he had to do it in a certain way. And the world is so oblivious to that wisdom that they can even attack and reject and mock the sacrifice on the cross. So let's look at some of the unbelieving attacks on the cross. Mahatma Gandhi said, "I could accept Jesus as a martyr, an embodiment of sacrifice, and a divine teacher. His death on the cross was a great example to the world, but that there was anything like a mysterious or miraculous virtue in it, my heart could not accept." Sadly, as it were, sealing his own doom in saying it. But to analyze it, you see, to accept Jesus as only a martyr embodying sacrifice relegates his sacrifice to an encouragement to bravery. Somebody having strong conviction. To accept him as a teacher implies humanity's innate ability to follow his teachings. To accept him as an example begs the question, example of what? Wearing a robe, submitting yourself to get beat up? What example are we trying to set here? This attack on the cross reduces Christ's death to really just one more good man killed for holding his chosen beliefs. An average skeptic says, "Why couldn't God just forgive us? Why would Jesus have to die?" It sounds like the vengeful gods of primitive times who needed to be appeased by human sacrifice. It's divine child abuse. This attack on the cross minimizes the debt of sin. If our sin against God was no more than forgetting to say hi when we passed on the street, he could probably just let that go. If our sin was serious enough to demand to incur the debt of death, then somehow the death would have to be paid. To picture it as vengeful God picking on hapless humans or abusive father guilty of child abuse is to betray complete, utter ignorance of Christ's deity, of his membership in the Trinity. While Christ the Son is not God the Father, both are Jehovah God. The Jehovah God who punished is the same Jehovah God who was punished. A Puritan denominational leader back in the 1990s, so long ago.
Puritan.
Oh, a Puritan? No, Protestant is what I meant. Protestant. Definitely not a Puritan. "I don't think we need a theory of atonement at all. I don't think we need folks hanging on crosses and blood dripping and weird stuff. Just let it go." This attack supposes that Christ's sacrifice was some additional, unnecessary ornament, something that was not at the very crux, at the very center of what Christianity is. That it could be dispensed with if we could focus on the main issue, which now is what? See, main issue is smiling at people or something. See? Yes, ma'am.
And he's gone back to atonement like it doesn't matter what it means. It's not just atonement. I mean, atonement was the Old Testament.
That's right. Atonement is covering. And so this is as far as these. A lot of the Protestants go, because it all comes from the Reformed protest movement. Well, let's examine then, why was the cross of Christ necessary, his sacrifice on the cross? Why was it necessary? And if we explore our hearts and minds in this thing, we'll recognize that these things are necessary. God was actually driven, once he had committed himself to this goal, he had committed himself to this action. Here's a material example. Your friend borrows your car, your insurance does not cover other drivers, and he gets into a car accident. He doesn't have any insurance, so there's only two proper ways to deal with the situation. One, you may expect him to pay for the damages, or you can forgive him the debt and pay for it yourself. Whether or not you forgive his debt, the debt must be paid if you're going to use your car. So here's the point. True forgiveness demands suffering. If you forgive him, you suffer the expense of repairs because the debt needs to be paid. Here's an emotional example. Many of the wrongs that are done to us are not measured in money. You betrayed me. Okay, here's $50. Yeah, that doesn't really make up for it. Now, $100 probably would, but perhaps you were robbed of happiness, of opportunity or freedom. Perhaps someone damaged your reputation, your peace of mind, or your sense of security. If you were seriously wronged, you recognize within your spirit that a debt is owed to you. They should do something about that, you see. The guilty one ought to pay for what he did. And again, there's only two responses you can have, just like the material example about the car. One response is to hold the wrongdoer accountable. The other is to forgive him. And then you, the forgiver, suffer the agony of not exacting revenge yourself. Why would you choose to suffer again just to forgive the perpetrator? And here is the reasoning that you need to keep in mind. The reason is that the only way to really hold the person accountable is to forgive them. To take personal revenge without forgiveness adds to the problem, causes serious problems. Here's the problems. First, you become harder and colder and more self-pitying and more self-absorbed. It's all about me. It's all about me, and you hurt me, and you're going to get it. See? Secondly, you typically color others like the perpetrator. So if he's wealthy, you dislike and resent anyone of wealth and influence because it's those wealthy people that do this stuff to you. If the person's of a different group, the opposite sex, different race, another nationality, you may become permanently cynical and prejudiced against all like him. That's nonsensical as well as not fair to everybody else. And thirdly, if your revenge is perceived by others as unjust or overly strict, then the friends and family of the perpetrator feel they have a right to retaliate the same way. Now they see you are guilty of what you're thinking he's guilty. So it's Hatfield McCoy's. Nancy just mouthed the answer. And that went on for years and years, and people were killing them because that's what we do. We forget why it started. God calls this fighting evil with evil, taking up evil for the sake of your campaign against evil. The wrong does not disappear. Instead, it spreads, and most tragically, it spreads into you, defiling you and your character. What begins as righting a wrong ends with increasing wrongs. So we don't want to go there. If you seek to hold a person accountable after forgiveness, you will confront the wrongdoer with certain specific goals. You may try to reveal to him his blind spot, some damaged character that he has, that he can hurt you and not even realize that he's doing it. Or you may encourage him to repair the damaged relationship, or at worst, find that this person needs to be put away, see? Restrain them, protect others in the future. But these goals, I hope you notice, are reasons of love. After you have personally forgiven, now to hold them accountable is to say, how can I help make you better? To urge repentance, to urge change, can make things right, or at least better. Love desires the best for the wrongdoer, or if he will not change, the society must deal with the wrongdoer. So you cannot say you want to hold him accountable, but really seek personal vengeance. You really want him to hurt rather than get better. Because it becomes obvious. The person you deal with will clearly see the difference. And then you set up the cycle of retaliation. It's only when you lose the need to see the other person hurt that you have any chance of bringing about real change. So you have to decide to suffer a death to vengeance and to experience the resurrection to a life, the kind of life of reconciliation and healing, a different way of living than the world knows. God calls this fighting evil with good. Far more powerful weapons. And then we've had the material and the emotional example. Let's look at the spiritual example. Because God is the greatest good. Any good, any perfect thing found among men has come from God. If we, being evil, know how to forgive and absorb all the debt of the wrong done, how much more does God know? The triune God was seriously wronged by us. You think about a child who deliberately acts in such a way that it defies what you're all about, that takes all that you have given and in a mocking sense uses all of it to contradict everything you stand for. That's what we did with God. His amazing love motivated him to pay our debt himself. And doing this took extraordinary measures. There were layers of suffering added to suffering. Christ had to leave heaven. Untold suffering involved in that, that we can't even imagine till we get there. He became as one of his own creation. How condescending is that? He accepted the life of one of the least of men, not the most powerful. He suffered misunderstanding and rejection, and that of his own family. He was betrayed by friends, and he suffered one of the most horrible deaths. So his death is not just an example of love. That's a foolish way of thinking. If a friend says, I want to show you how much I love you, and he jumps out the window to his death, you're going, what? You're not so much impressed with his love as you are depressed with his irrational thinking. What a sad person that was. However, if you are drowning and a friend jumps in and saves you, but then, tragically, he's caught by the current and dies, you take steps through your life forever amazed at his loving sacrifice. Christ was paying the debt you owed. And why would he do that? Just because of his desire to forgive you. because he loved you. Let me close with this thought, that true love demands personal exchange. The death on the cross is an example of God's true love. Personal exchange. God reveals to us that he is love. Love defines his being. Ephesians 2, 4 through 7 explains that God went to the cross for us because of love, so that in the ages to come he could show to angels and men, to anyone else, what kind of a being he was. Without the cross, there is no God of love. Now, God's definition of love is very different from some human definitions. God's love sacrifices self for the good of the loved one. All true Christian love does that. Here's examples of that in human relationships. Good parents show this love to their helpless, dependent children. The kids can't give back. Say to the little baby in the arms, "Why don't you get a job? Help out with a family." We don't even, it's too ridiculous. Bad parents value their own freedom and their own interests over the child. That's what makes them bad parents. A good parent limits his freedom to pour himself into the life of the child. Personal exchange. A good husband restricts his freedom and desires to protect and support and love his wife. A good wife shows love to her husband by restricting her independence, learning proper submission. And so a loving family accepts severe limitations to their life to care for an aging parent. A loving counselor drinks in, absorbs the emotional grief of a damaged person to give that person a measure of the counselor's own strength. It's a personal exchange. Some movies portray the innocent man being chased by secret agents or the government. And then he finds someone who is his only hope. And our choice is like that. You may choose to turn away from the man and let him die because I have a luncheon to attend or something. Or you can choose to help and take on the risk of being killed yourself. It's a personal exchange, human example. But let's go into the divine example of personal exchange. John Stott, in his book, The Cross of Christ, said this: the essence of sin is we, human beings, substituting ourselves for God, while the essence of salvation is God substituting himself for us. We put ourselves where only God deserves to be. God puts himself where we deserve to be. Do you see that personal exchange? We do not really understand the cross until we grasp that Jesus did not just suffer for us. He also suffered with us. See, I can imagine a situation where he appears in the clouds and then suffers for us. A giant lightning bolt blasts him and his blood is shed and we're done. But he did not do that. Instead, he became like us. He suffered the same violence, the same oppression, the same grief, the same weakness, the same pain that we must suffer in this sin-cursed world. He didn't just die on the cross for us. He walked the path of life with us, you see, experiencing it on his own. So he honored God's justice by suffering for us, paying our debt of death. But he identifies with us as he was oppressed with sin's curse by suffering with us. Christ tried to explain this way of thinking to his disciples. Luke 22. There was also a strife among them, his disciples, which of them should be accounted the greatest. And he said unto them, look. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But ye shall not be so. That's not the way I want you followers of me to be. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, for the younger is the server. He that is chief, be as he that doth serve. I remember talking to a man who grew up in a larger family, and he was the youngest. And his job, he had to shine everybody's shoes on Saturday night. And he got to be really good at shoe shining. I never wanted to take it up as an occupation, but he had to clean the mud off. There were farm people. You know, he had to clean all the mud and muck off. And then, so wash them down, and then dry them off, and then put the dye on it, and then put the wax on there and shine it up really nice. That was his job because he was the youngest. He had no seniority. He couldn't tell anybody what to do. Think for a moment of what Christ is saying here. He says that I want you in love to serve one another, not try to lord it over. Jesus accomplished this on the cross. He exposed and defeated the world's quest for self-glory and power and status. But how did he do it? He overcame by seeming to lose. He triumphed by entering into defeat. He achieved power through human weakness. And he came to ultimate wealth by giving away all that he had. He accomplished both justice and mercy at the same time. For justice, he suffered to forgive. And for mercy, he personally exchanges our inability for his total ability. Christ, in his dying weakness, cried, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" And then Christ, in his resurrected omnipotence, answers the question, "It was to save you." Hebrews 2:9. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death. Now we see him crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. The cross of Christ was necessary to accomplish what God intended to accomplish, salvation by grace. And the ignorance of the world about who he is, what he was trying to accomplish, makes the cross almost an extravagance of suffering. Comments or questions?
One thing that I hate about philosophers and religious theologians is their first words out of their mouth is, "I think, I believe, I, instead of saying, "The Bible tells us," and we should look for that. Mm-hmm.
Matthew loaned me a DVD, people speaking on the death of truth and the destruction of our society and culture. And a Jewish man was speaking, and he said, I had a life-changing experience in fourth grade. He was in Hebrew school, and the time came for the afternoon prayer. And so he went up to the rabbi and he said, I'm not in the mood. And so the rabbi said, okay, let's think about this. And he gave his name and he says, he is not in the mood for the afternoon prayer that God and the Torah have commanded. So what? And he said it was a life-changing experience. Because what he wanted, how he felt, what he thought, didn't mean a thing. That was a good point. We are so inflated with our own way of thinking. We say, but I don't want to. God in the world comes back and says, so what? Yeah, we have no concept of what we're doing.
If we could have an inkling of that kind of compassion, which we do, the example of being parents, I think, is so telling. There's this little thing, you forgive him for all his misgivings at both ends, you know, it's nothing to you. It is nothing. You just take care of it, and you go on, and the love grows. Think of our Heavenly Father who is already love.
That's powerful. Nancy, do you have?
I was wondering what that verse means about heaping coals of fire upon their head. Is that getting vengeance in a different way, or does that mean?
I think finally, ultimately, there is a little bit of that, but the thing is, it didn't come from your hand, and this is the vengeance of God. That he promises.
That doesn't mean sending him home with a pan of coals to start a fire.
No, no. This is, this person is their, is your enemy, and they're trying to hurt you. You find out what they need. You give them food to eat. You give them something to drink. You meet a need. And when you do that, that kindness puts coals of fire on their head. You don't have to load up a pan of coals at all.
I think that in that we need to remember that the Bible doesn't say that nothing is going to be done. He's not saying, you know, set aside the idea of justice and such. He says, let me avenge it.
That's right.
You forgive, I will avenge.
Yeah. So if you can imagine how an enemy would have screwed up their heart, made it hard and cold, said, I'm going to try to get them. And you respond with self-sacrificing love. How that twists and turns and how that changes and how it burns. And that's the coals of fire. In a lot of ways, I think I have been motivated to step out of the way because God's saying, would you like to see vengeance? Get out of my way. And somewhere along the way, you can actually pray, don't take too much vengeance, you know, because I truly forgive. But God always does perfectly, correctly.